Lawrence, let's talk about the white powder of gold from the past, and then we'll get into the future here in the current period of how this was rediscovered by an Arizona farmer.
Yeah.
In the ancient days, how was it being used, and how do you think they even stumbled across it?
The references to it, as I mentioned, they come from generally that sort of area of the Middle East, which incorporates Iraq across to Egypt, across Palestine, Sinai, that sort of thing. And there are many old references. It's called a number of things. They call it Shemana, they call it Mufkut, they call it Shefa, you know, various things. And it's portrayed, the temples that were dedicated to manufacturing it and whatever were actually called the houses of gold, and the chief priest was called the treasurer, that sort of thing. Now, quite how they originally got onto it is truly impossible to say. You know, one could speculate that it was a science from the gods, perhaps, or something of that sort, but whatever, it would be a speculation. The clear fact is that they knew of it. Even if they didn't understand how the science works as we do today, they knew what it would do, and they knew how to achieve it, how to manufacture it. I mean, the Bible has a wonderful little story in there that was, I think, really what brought my attention to it first of all. There's a story in Exodus where Moses and the Israelites have come out of Egypt, and they're camped at Mount Sinai, and we have the story of building the Ark of the Covenant, and Moses has gone up the mountain to talk with God and come back with the Ten Commandments, and he appears at the bottom of the mountain only to discover that his brother Aaron, in his absence, has collected all the golden earrings from the Israelites and melted them down and made this golden calf as an idol of worship. And, you know, clearly the story is in there to sort of make the point that we're moving historically from a period of worshipping golden idols to worshipping the new one God of the Israelites at that time. But the story is kind of interesting. It says Moses grew angry. He took the golden calf that his brother had made. He burnt it with fire. He transposed it into powder, mixed the powder with water, and fed it to the Israelites, gave it to them to drink. Now, that's kind of extraordinary. You know, theologians have wondered about this for quite a long time, but they've never really discussed it because there was no way to discuss it. And the question is, how do you take gold and burn it with fire and end up with a powder? Well, I mean, what you get is molten gold. You don't necessarily get powder. Well,
right.
That was what was understood. And that seems to be the logical fact of science until recent times. But we now know that actually the story is highly possible and highly plausible. Heat, fire, electricity, certain chemical ways of doing it. There are a number of ways of shocking the gold so that it simply forgets that it's a metal. The metal-metal bonds between the atoms just simply fall apart, and the atoms separate and can't reconfigure themselves as metal anymore. And what's extraordinary about that is the moment that happens, if you then analyze it, it doesn't even tell you that it was gold. It tells you that it's something completely different. And you know, that was really where the research started back in the 1970s when it was rediscovered. What on earth was this amazing material?
You mean it would change its properties?
It does. I mean, literally, it changes its properties totally. Everything that we understand becomes what it is. I mean, I suppose one can use the word vibrations, because the atoms vibrate in a particular way so that they sit in front of us visually in a particular way. But it's all about the vibration of atoms and how they knit together. Now, if one, for example, were to reconfigure those atoms and vibrate them in a different way or send them through a different frequency, the end product would be different. For example, I mean, these materials, one can begin with gold, or one can begin with platinum, or one can end up with this gold powder, but if you take a slightly different route along the way, and it's not much of a variable, actually, you end up with glass, a beautiful crystal glass of most astonishing quality, which contains its own light. It really shines at you, and whatever metal you started with determines the ultimate color of this glass. And that seems, in fact, not provably, but it seems to answer the big question that has always been there about how did the Knights Templars get that extraordinary Gothic glass into their cathedrals. Nobody has been able to analyze it properly, but true Gothic glass, whether it's day or night, it doesn't seem to matter. It just shines at you from the inside as if the sun is outside. And this glass literally carries its own light waves, and that's the secret of this stuff. Within these atoms, the electrons are spinning in a very different way to the way that they were before. The nucleus changes its shape. It elongates from being a sort of round thing, and it's scientifically called deformed or super deformed. And once it's in that state, its properties change. It actually really moves into a situation where you begin to see that its content is not even solid. It's a light wave. It's not even like a physical particle, this nucleus. It's a true light wave. And again, remarkably, what's been discovered now is that this light wave that exists within this powder substance is a slow-moving light wave. It moves at the speed of sound, so you can activate it with the sound frequency. And it's very... not very easy, I mean, that sounds glib. It's very possible to trigger that light wave to the light waves in DNA, in the human body.
Now, explain that for me.
That's the way that they're looking at it for cancer treatment now. It is actually a DNA, a malformed DNA corrector.
How would that work like that?
Well, again, it was discovered by accident. There was some scientists, this was in Scientific American, if I remember correctly, were doing some research back in 1995. And what they did, they took a single atom of, or two single atoms of ruthenium, that's one of the platinum groups, and there's actually a picture of this, a graphic picture in the article in Scientific American, and they decided to attach a single atom to each end of a double helix DNA strand. Now, it's a bit like asking why did they, you know, how did they discover it? I don't know why they decided to do that, but they were looking at the electrical properties of DNA. And what they discovered was that the moment that they did this, the DNA strand became 10,000 times more conductive than it was before. In fact, it moved into the realms of being a superconductor rather than a straightforward electric conductor. So it was conducting light waves, and they discovered at that time that DNA communicates with each other in the body through these light waves. Now, these light waves are replicated within monatomic elements. And the moment you heighten DNA with the monatomic elements, light waves, you achieve a sort of corrector for the DNA. What happens is that the DNA becomes so highly energized that it's actually able to sit back in a way and say to itself, hey, you know, I've become a little deformed here. I shouldn't be like this. What should I be like? And it will correct itself in accordance with its original memory. And if one thinks about, you know, a number of diseases, cancer is the obvious one, it is nothing more than a deformed or malformed cellular structure. The DNA gets out of a kilter. And so what's happening here is that we have potentially, and I say potentially because although it's been tried and it's been tested, it's not in the public domain yet as such, but we have not something that will kill cancer. It's not a cancer killer, it's a pro-life substance. So it's not about surgery, it's not about amputation, it's not about radiation and bombarding you with horrible things that affect your immune system. It's a straightforward corrector of the deformity.